Most bankers aren't ready to help you until after their third cup of coffee. But with Central National Bank's after-hours service, you don't have to wait for the bank lobby to open to get help. You can contact us from 6 to 8:30 in the morning or from 5 to 10 in the evening, and we'll connect you to a real, live, local person who can answer questions and fix problems 7 days a week. Bank different. Bank Central. Central National Bank. Member FDIC.
This is a Rogue Media Network podcast.
Bite hard, that'll make it by dawn. Cross the Brazos and Waco. I'm safe when I reach San Antonio.
All right, welcome back to the Waco History Podcast. I've got some friends and colleagues here that represent one of our older entities in town that's interested in historic preservation and continues to do great work and has a youthful energy, I would say, with it right now under the leadership of these two fine gentlemen. One serves as the president of Historic Waco, Eric Ames.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so Eric is a old friend of the pod. You can listen to the tornado episode. You can listen to the episode of Hidden History of Waco. Again, and I will say, if you're at HEB and you're checking out, listening to this, look to your left and grab a copy of Eric Ames' Hidden History of Waco, and Eric gets a quarter.
I certainly do. My children's, like I said before, my children's college fund thanks you.
Yeah, so do that. And then Eric Swanson is with us, the executive director or the director?
Executive director.
Let's call it executive director, the potentate over at Historic Waco. And Eric's been in that position
2 years and change.
Yeah, so about 2 years. Eric previously worked with Eric and I in the university libraries at Baylor University. And so Historic Waco Foundation had a long life in Waco, has a long life in Waco. Historic Waco currently rebranded. And of course, these two gents led that rebranding effort to rebrand as Historic Waco. And we'll talk about that at some point. But I would love to dive in for those of you that are saying, what is that? So if you could talk a little bit about an organization I was involved in at one point in more recent history, but has a long history here in town. And I would suspect the average listener may not know some of that long history. So whoever wants to field this one, if you could.
It's the Spider-Man meme where all the Erics are
pointing at each other. If you could go back to, say, the 60s and good times and give us a little bit of the history of Historic Waco Foundation.
Go right ahead, Mr. Swanson. Mr. Director.
Historic Waco really came from three separate entities. And all three of those entities each had a different historic house. So it was the Duncan Foundation. They had... Which house did they have?
E.N.K.
E.N.K.
Earl Napier Kennard.
E.N.K. The Earl Napier Kennard. Mm-hmm. People who can't say E.N.K. quickly. Mm-hmm. You had the... Oh, what are the other two?
The Heritage Society had East Terrace. And then the Society for Historic Preservation, not to be confused with the Heritage Society, was Fort House.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then McCullough House. So as we talk about the main four properties that HWF has managed... And McCullough comes a little bit later. Yeah. Okay. So we have these three entities in place that are coming together with each with their own historic home, each 19th century, 1870s, 1880s structures. So they come together and then what happens?
So essentially the mission for all the organizations was roughly the same. Mm-hmm. You kind of had the organization were really interested just in their specific houses. But then when the three groups came together, they really started expanding their vision to interpreting the history of Waco itself and not just those houses. Mm-hmm. And really, I think the original vision was to use the houses as sort of a backdrop and really use that to explain, hey, here's how Waco has evolved. Because when you look at these houses, you see lots of add-ons and additions. That's because a lot of the houses started as smaller cabins. Mm-hmm. And then as people came in, new owners were cycled in, the houses were built along with the city of Waco. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that was the original intent behind that initial merger, because a lot of the divisions, what they had to do, were very similar.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about, in a really tertiary sense, some of the families that were associated. But if y'all could talk a little bit about the families associated really with those three structures that were kind of the core of HWF.
So at East Terrace, you have the Mann family, mm-hmm. Howard Mann. He was a very well-known businessman entrepreneur in Waco. And actually, when you look at the suspension bridge, before they redid it recently, you can kind of see the exposed bricks underneath. So those bricks were the same bricks from the same company that actually helped make East Terrace. Mm-hmm. So you already have that direct Waco connection there. So the Mann family, and that house, I think it was started in 1872, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then with a few additions on later in the 70s, in the early 80s. I think it's 1880 was the next addition, 1883 after that. Mm-hmm. For the McCullough House, you have Dr. Josiah Caldwell, and he was actually one of the first doctors in Waco. And so he initially just had that small cabin. I believe it was him and his wife, and I think six kids he had, which is a really fun story to tell guests, because you can imagine, hey, if you have a brother or sister, can you imagine six of them and now in one small room with nothing to do? Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a different way of living. But so the focus for that house really is just, what would a doctor's office had looked like back then?
Yeah.
And then for the Earl Napier Kennard House, it's the Earls, the Napiers, and then the Kennards first. Mm-hmm. So, but it was the Earls who had that first initial addition to the house.
Okay. And so just so folks will have a spot of what we're talking about, East Terrace, that grand house that's on MLK now, kind of overlooking has the best vista overlooking the Brazos River there. That is East Terrace. The McCullough House kind of behind the county tax office there over on Columbus.
Yes.
Yeah, yep. Over on Columbus. So that is McCullough House, and then our Earl Napier Kennard continually battling I-35 to keep its presence over by the historic Waco offices and probably a better reference point in and out right across
the
street.
I'm a Californian, so I can appreciate the reference.
Yeah.
The irony is thick.
Yeah, yeah. So those places are very historic sites that were homes to these very prominent families early in Waco's history, definitely.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that this all happened in the late 60s, because in 65, you have the demolition of Penn Station, which is sort of one of those watershed moments in historic preservation where people said, okay, if this can happen to this grand Parthenon of train transportation in New York City, the most important city in the world, it can happen in any city. And so you get the genesis of the historic preservation movement starting in the mid 60s, historic Waco forms in 67. And then you get the big run up to the bicentennial. You know, every town that had a historic house left in it would say, okay, the bicentennial is coming, let's save the Jones House. And that certainly was a motivator for that mid-century preservation mindset. And I think historic Waco played right into that. Mm-hmm. It was a great opportunity to grab onto some of the things that were left. Of course, we had the tornado in 53 that did a lot of structural damage around town. You had urban renewal. You had all these civil rights and other upheaval sort of moments. You can understand why there would be a psychological need to hold on to some of the past built environment and some of the stories, and to start to tell those stories in a new way. So I think it was part of the zeitgeist going around.
Yeah, you had federal legislation in the 60s to help you support it. But I will say, even McCullough House, which of course is kind of in the shadow of urban renewal where it's located over there, these are certain types of houses we're preserving. So I'm interested in kind of we can't get inside the minds of those that are making these decisions in the 1960s, but what kind of general movement or class or group is kind of pushing for these preservation, and maybe how are they using the properties in the 60s and 70s?
So I actually went back to one of the earliest magazines of Waco's Heritage and History. Mm-hmm. And the first episode talks about the Brazos River Festival. So mm-hmm. that was already something that they were doing. And I think they actually described it as the Brazos River Festival in pilgrimage. And when they were discussing these houses, it was essentially just honoring these post-Civil War houses that were built and the legacy of the families who had it. So really the intention was just honoring these wealthy individuals who came in and made an impact on the town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's probably emblematic of a number of the houses like this in other cities around the country, especially the South, in that the stories focus on primarily the white male patriarch of a family. Here's a symbol of their status. Here's a symbol of their, you know, their wealth in the community. They've built this grand house that very few people around them could replicate. And so it was sort of, I hate to use the phrase, but it was sort of the great white male story of history that was very prevalent prior to the social history movement that would come a little later. So I think this desire to tell people about some of the city fathers and the way they, you know, pulled themselves up and built their industries and became prominent in the city was a big part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. And that left out the voices of the working class, that left out the voices of the people who, in one case in the city now with one of the properties we manage, enslaved persons who were involved in the construction of that place. It really glossed over or omitted those stories altogether. And I think that was a major blind spot for a lot of groups, but it's certainly Historic Waco over the years. And that's something that today we're trying to turn around and to change that perspective.
And that's, you know, again, Waco, Historic Waco is not alone in that sort of historic house where these places came from, why they were preserved, you know, what stories they're telling early on. I think that's fairly typical, particularly of Southern historic homes. You use the word heritage, and what is heritage?
Yeah.
What does heritage mean? I'm always interested as a historian. What does heritage mean? But I mean, that's why these places were preserved. You mentioned the Brazos River Festival, which was a cool event that HWF did early on. What are some other ways in which they're using the homes? Let's say 60s, 70s, and 80s. What are some other things that might be on the annual schedule?
So another thing that happened in, I think it was 1971, was the revival of the Cotton Palace pageant. And so the houses were essentially a stop for one of those, at least in 1971. I'm not sure how long that relationship continued or not, but I think they were definitely trying to be included in that conversation. And then obviously we still had tours going on at the houses, but the thing that I was surprised is that every year they still decorated for Christmas. And so that was something, that's a tradition that we still do to this
Christmas
very year.
COB, Christmas on the Brazos.
Christmas on the Brazos.
Yeah. Yeah. Very big event. And I, you know, I that relationship, of course, we've talked about the Cotton Palace, but, you know, the Cotton Palace pageant, this revival of it in the 70s and 80s, it seems like Historic Waco is well positioned to be part of that effort.
Yes.
To kind of revive the glory of the in every, you know, I think every Southern town wants to have its coming out sort of, or coming of age sort of thing. Maybe I shouldn't use coming out, but coming of age sort of festival where young men and young women are presented to the community. And so I think of Bells and Bows with a Historic Waco Foundation, and the Cotton Palace pageant kind of becomes a vehicle for that locally, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting role that Historic Waco can play with stories that maybe have lost their tether to the location where they traditionally used to happen. So the Cotton Palace grounds, long gone. But those stories persist, and the activity of this, as you said, this sort of debutante coming out activity is still important. But who do we partner with to keep that story alive? How is that going to be preserved, and where? And where would you stage something like that, and with what partners? So when we look at maybe events or places or things or groups that don't have a physical home. To me, that's one of the niches that Historic Waco can fill, is to gather those stories and give them a place to be interpreted. As Eric said before, you know, we have to think outside the walls of the houses. Those stories are fairly static. We can certainly reinterpret spaces within. We can tell different versions of the stories that happen in the house, but those are very locked to a location most of the time. We have to tell a bigger story, a community story that's a multifaceted community. And it's not just the stories that maybe were privileged above others for so many years. You know, we're having to do a lot of new work to try to change that perception and bring in voices that have been maybe omitted from the conversation over the past 60 years.
Yeah, because one of my first, I won't tell a lot of secrets, but so I was involved with HWF for about 11 years. One of my first meetings was about the collection at HWF. And so I'm going to ask you in a minute what all is in the collection, but it was a conversation about whether we should keep the door open or the door closed upstairs with regard to the preservation of the collection. And it was about a 30-minute discussion on whether we should keep the door open
oh, wow.
or the door closed. But, you know, I think about the assets that HWF has. There is the houses, obviously, mm-hmm. that are in really important assets that Historic Waco has. What are some other things that might be in the collection that most folks wouldn't know about?
So, again, most of the collection that we have, they're physically present in the houses. Mm-hmm. Dr. Haferteep likes to say there's different tiers of historic houses. And some historic houses, and that's just sort of the nature of the business, a lot of the houses came into the possession of these organizations because the owners, they either went broke or the owners died. They didn't have anything to give it to her. So a lot of the houses just came with nothing in them. Mm-hmm. So in the 60s, when these houses were gifted to the Historic Waco, really a lot of them came with furniture that they had to reacquire. So not a lot of stuff is original in the houses, mm-hmm. which is why it's more special when you do find things that are from the original owners. So East Terrace House, a lot of the furniture in there, a lot of it is from the original owners, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, the biggest component of our collection is, honestly, we have a lot of textiles, mm-hmm. Lots of dresses, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. I would say probably the most unique thing we have in our collection is something called the Washington Elm. And this is something that just came out recently. Essentially, the story goes that George Washington gave some speech by this elm tree, and they chopped it down, and they gave a slice of the tree to all of the initial governors who were there at the time. And then for some reason, it was gifted to Pat Neff when he was governor of Texas.
Okay.
And then it was passed down to us. So again, it's not something that's related to Waco's history at all, but it's definitely one of those sort of cabinet of curiosities. You're like, oh, this is kind of cool.
We could put that with Washington's vest at the Helen Marie Taylor Museum of Waco's History, have a whole Washington Museum.
One more item and we can summon his ghost. I think you have to have three.
It's like Candyman.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or Beetlejuice.
Or Beetlejuice. And I think we found out not too long ago as well that there's a piece of dressed stone, so essentially a large brick, on the property at Hoffman House that we found out was from the building that was the R.T. Dennis building.
It's, oh, wow.
Someone referred to it probably mistakenly as a cornerstone. It's not a quarterstone, but it is one of the large stones that would have been on the foundation or lower levels from the R.T. Dennis. Mm. But as with a lot of things that show up at a place like Historic Waco, there's not a ton of provenance or documentation.
Yeah.
You know, who scooped it up after the tornado? Where did it live prior to that? Why did it wind up here? Those are some of the things that we have to sometimes dig through lots of old records to put those stories back together and then put them in a more accessible place so that we're not rediscovering this 50 years down the line.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a challenge, right? I mean, you could become Waco's attic. I mean, you know, we've got something old. We don't know what to do with it. I know.
Yes.
Let's leave it like an abandoned baby on the steps of Hoffman House, and then maybe someone will care for it.
Yes. There is an after-hours drop box for your antiques that, you know, your mom wants to throw
out.
Don't
encourage this.
No. To all our listeners, please don't leave boxes of things at Hoffman House.
But that's, you know, we're joking about it, but that's a real challenge, right?
It is. Mm-hmm.
To stay within the boundaries of your mission and to, because that, one of the efforts I was involved in is reviewing the collection policy, which is a constant kind of thing. Review the collection policy and update the collection policy. Because of that unclear nature of how things are acquired over time and why they're acquired and what, you know, how do they connect to the mission
exactly
of what you're trying to accomplish. And so the mission of Historic Waco is?
The history and the preservation of Waco's history.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I expected y'all to say that in unison, but that's fine.
Yeah. We'll have to work on that at the board retreat. And I think for a long time, the mindset was, well, the easiest way to do that is through things that we put in the house.
Yeah.
You can walk by and look at someone's desk. You can walk by and look at this china that belonged to a family. And there's still definitely a connection there, that those tangible pieces of history. But increasingly, I think what we're looking at is, how do we save more stories? Mm-hmm. How do we not at any point get anywhere close to the Oral History Institute, but how do we play a part in talking to our own volunteers about their experiences with Historic Waco over the years? What stories have you learned and what have you seen change? You know, how can we document stories from different communities around Waco? Because those don't take up the kind of space or present the same kind of challenge as a box that shows up on the front porch. You want to do them right. You want to do them justice. We want to make sure that they're done professionally. But those are the kinds of things that I think we can do differently and with the space that we have versus somewhere that maybe has a larger physical footprint to store things.
Mm-hmm. So things that that folks may be aware of. So Attic Treasures is it still an annual event, I'm assuming?
My first year when I came in, we did Attic Treasures. The year after that, we didn't really have a space, so we took it a year off. We had intended to do it this year, but again, the building that we had, it was unavailable, essentially. So we're still looking for a location. But I still get calls, I think it's almost every week, for someone saying, oh, where's the Attic Treasures drop-off? And I'm like, it's not this year.
Yeah, so but a fixture for a long time in Waco, a very, I don't want to insult it, but a high-end garage sale. Maybe I should take the garage out there. Antiquity sale. Where you could go and buy things.
Yes.
And Attic Treasures was a big deal every year and a big fundraiser, a big fundraiser to support the efforts of Historic Waco. We mentioned Christmas on the Brazos is an annual event. What are some other things that folks may be aware of that were longstanding kind of programs of Historic Waco?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's longstanding, but when Jill Barrow came on as executive director, she started a program of fun days, which were aimed at children. Of course, she had a heart for children's education. She was involved with the Ollie Mae Moen Discovery Center for many years and was an educator. So that's where her heart and her talent lie. So we would have fun days. We would do, of course, school field trips and costumed interpretation on site for different holidays and big events. For a number of years, we did Sitting Up with the Dead, which was around Halloween and would kind of focus more on Victorian funerary rites and the spookier side of the houses, but still being grounded in truth. You know, what would happen if someone passed away in late 19th century Waco? How would you prepare the body for a wake or a funeral at the home? What kinds of rituals would have been done to decorate the houses? So it had that kind of spooky element to it, but it was always with the intention of teaching and helping people understand the way those things worked from a historical basis. So, you know, we've tried a lot of programming over the years, and a lot of credit to Eric for trying new ideas since he's come on board. Post-COVID, you know.
It's rough.
The whole industry is having to try to figure out, you know, how do we make these sites relevant in a new way to a new people, to people who are a lot more fractured and distracted. How do we keep them interested in something that we've been doing for 50 years, but maybe they don't care as much as they did 50 years ago? Finding new ways to do programming, even if it's not going to be something we do every year for 30 years, if it gets us people in the door and it gets them to understand what we're about, we're trying, you know, new angles on that.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of an aha moment that we had when we realized it's not necessarily that we have to teach people something whenever they come to the houses. In our mind, if they're through the doors and they're having a good time, that's a success. And if we just happen to teach them something at the very end, sneak a little morsel of history in there, that's even better. I think an event that kind of checks all those boxes was the murder mystery that we put on last year. And so we'd done one 2 years ago. It was just kind of on a whim. We didn't really have a set plan. It wasn't like a historical murder mystery. It was just, it's a murder mystery where it's at the McCullough House. And I was surprised by the amount of people. We had 30 something people show up. I was expecting maybe 10 to 15. People had a great time. They dressed up, which we didn't ask them to. Everyone just sort of dressed up in period clothing, which was tremendous. So we really decided to double down. And so we worked with Jerry Powell, author, and we asked him to write us a script. And so the idea that we had was that we know that Bonnie and Clyde, Bonnie essentially smuggled a gun to Clyde in jail because he was arrested here for stealing cars. And he broke out of jail with that pistol. And then that later he fled and was arrested. And that's when after he escaped for the second time, that's when he began infamous murder spree. But before that, they really had their roots here in Waco. So what we wanted to do was try to find a way to tie that history with just Waco's history in general. So we did some research on it. And we found out that one of the cars he actually stole was William Cameron's car, Cameron Park. So what we wanted to do was have Mr. Howard Mann, or not Howard Mann, his son. I can't think of his
John
name.
John Wesley?
No. Probably.
Shoot.
One of the mans. Yeah, a man was essentially hosting a dinner party. And then there was supposed to be a deal with the Dr. Pepper bottling plant. And then you had executives from Dallas coming in. And so you have this dinner party, and then the night of the party, you have Bonnie and Clyde, they escape out of prison, and then their car drives by East Terrace, shots ring out, somebody, a guest, falls dead. And so what our murder mystery party guests had to figure out is, was it Bonnie and Clyde who murdered them, or was it perhaps one of the actual guests?
Betting on it was not Bonnie and Clyde.
You think that's a red herring?
It's a little too obvious.
A little too on the nose.
Yeah, can you tell me who did it? Do you remember who did it?
I know exactly who did it, but we're going to be doing it again.
Don't want to spoil that.
That's right.
So when are you doing it?
We're actually doing it for a church group is actually going to be doing it for us at the end of April. And then we're also doing one open to the public in September.
Mm. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that connects to another thread here is, you know, getting people in the houses, that idea of using the houses for events, you know, and that this is something that was always talked about. Weddings in the houses, receptions in the houses, how do we use the houses? I'm interested in kind of thoughts on how that's evolved over time and maybe how you're approaching that now.
Yeah. So I can say for right now, the weddings that we've had, I think we've had 4 or 5 since I've become director, specifically at the historic Waco houses that we own. Mm-hmm. The only interior wedding.
Are those people still together?
They haven't come to us.
You should track that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Success rate. Yeah.
For historic houses. Yeah. It's double the national average. Don't get married at a church. Get married at a historic home.
Well, that was a big decision, though. I mean, that was there was a lot of hand wringing over that question over the years of whether to hold those sorts of events in the houses.
And it's difficult. Even at the party that we had, the murder mystery, we specifically had signs saying, hey, don't sit in any of the furniture. And I swear, within 10 minutes of the event starting, somebody sat in the furniture and just broke something. So I understand why there was a debate for weddings in the houses. Mm-hmm. And actually, the only house that we allow weddings to happen inside is at McCullough.
Okay.
And that's only, it's like 20 to 25 people. Yeah. It's basically a micro wedding.
Yeah.
But usually the other weddings are held out on the grounds.
Okay.
So that way it's a little bit more controlled.
Yeah.
But if the couple wants to get pictures, obviously they can go inside the house.
Well, the East Terrace Ballroom would be the draw there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as a place to do weddings. Did anybody bring firearms for the, I'm thinking of risk to the homes. Did anybody bring live firearms to the murder mystery event?
We had a fake Tommy gun.
Okay.
Fantastic. Actually, it was real, but it wasn't, the firing pin was out.
Yeah. Okay. No longer functional. But it was a real Tommy gun.
It was a real Tommy gun.
Yeah, and that's an interesting balance that we have to think about all the time. You know, with these houses, they risk becoming sort of empty shells that are only occasionally accessed, and then all kinds of problems can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're not going into them on a regular basis, making sure that everything's running with the HVAC, making sure there's no water leaks, you run the risk of something happening you don't become aware of until too late. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, having someone come in at a function and sit on something could damage a piece of furniture, but if we don't find a way to integrate these into community events and make them a living part of the city, they risk becoming, demolished by neglect. Mm-hmm. We can't rely on tours to come in regularly enough by themselves to keep them active and open and to keep our eyes on everything. It's a very small staff. Eric has just a few additional staff members that help him do everything, in addition to the board of directors and the volunteers. It's largely a labor of love. And so those events do provide us with reasons to keep the doors open and funds to help keep the doors open, frankly.
Yeah. So it's a membership organization. Mm-hmm. So you can become, as I am, a member of Historic Waco.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. That's what I was looking for.
This will be
for.
The time to talk to you about raising your membership level while you're on the record.
Am I a sustainer?
I think sustainer looks good on you. We'll take the check after this.
So one tension I would think in your efforts is, you think of telling new stories, and then what assets do you have to use to tell those stories? And you talked about your textile collection and your house collection. You know, that's obviously a strength of the organization, but how do you work to tell new stories if the story is not connected to the place that you have access to?
So that's a great question. And really that was something that when I came in, that was what I tried to do. Exactly what you said. What are things that we can leverage in each one of the houses? What are connections that we can have to the larger Waco community in general? Or what are things that specifically these houses have that no one else has?
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the ballroom for East Terrace.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at that. It's an actual reinforced ballroom designed for people to dance on it. And so we thought to ourselves, boy, it'd be really cool if we have an event that's just ballroom dancing. And so it was a Baylor organization came in and they basically taught our guests how to dance in a ballroom on Valentine's Day. And it was tremendous. And it was definitely something that we're hopefully going to be doing again. So that was one example of kind of just leveraging what we have and doing something different. Going forwards, I think we really are trying to make more of a conscious effort to telling more stories that are relatable to the people of Waco. Because as Eric mentioned earlier, the houses that were saved, that are preserved, are typically the expensive houses, the people who are wealthy and could afford them. So one thing we're trying to do is find different ways that we can connect people. And I think a good way we're doing that is through food. So actually, we have... It's almost close to being promoted to the public, so maybe we'll break it live here.
All right. Well, but this is not live, but you can break it.
So we're going to have it's basically a walking food tour, and we're going to be doing this at the Pape Gardens,
okay.
The Earl Herring House Pape Gardens.
Yeah.
And so essentially, we plan on using that property, and basically it's telling different stories through food. So the first one we're going to be doing is a Pat Neff walking food tour. And so we chose him because he actually has a lot of connections to our houses. If you go to the McCullough house, there's a globe and the upstairs that was actually owned by him. If you go to East Terrace, this is kind of a sidebar, but there was a man by the name of Dr. Charles Lemley, and he was a chiropractor in Waco, Texas. And actually at the time it was illegal to be a
We practice. Have a podcast on Dr. Lemley, arrested 66 times.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And allegedly Pat Neff actually represented him.
Yeah, he defended him at one point. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have this Pat Neff connection to a lot of our houses. And so we found a menu from the Texas collection that talks about It was a dinner he had. It was either his inauguration as governor or when he was leaving as governor. So essentially, we're picking food from that menu, and then we're just going to have who is it? Not TSTC. The high school.
University High.
Thank you, University High.
Other culinary program.
Yeah, which is a tremendous by the record. And they're going to be basically cooking for that, so guests are going to be able to experience. Hey, who was Pat Neff? What was he like? And here's some food that he was eating at the time. And so that's something that's just a really simple concept that you can really adapt to a variety of different cultures, a variety of different foods. You could do, okay, what was food like in the 1800s? What was food like in the early 1920s? We could even expand it to, hey, what are food from restaurants that used to exist in Waco that are no longer exist these days? That's something we're really excited about. And I don't know if Historic Waco has done something specifically centered around food before. I'm sure maybe they have in the past. I'm just not aware of it.
If you could whip up some Leslie's fried chicken, I would be all in for that.
Maybe
some of those rolls.
You know, the last sign from the Leslie's location is in Austin. And if you drive past the art studio where the man has it in his backyard, you can see it over the fence. There's the Leslie's chicken.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd have to have some interactive where someone throws a roll over something. But I think you're onto something, Dr. Sloan.
Well, you mentioned Pape Gardens and Harrison. Can you talk about that relationship and how that kind of came about and how that's part of your assets now or relationship now?
So Eric can probably talk a little bit more about the beginning of how it started, because this is a relation that started even before I was hired.
So Clint Lynch from Oakwood Cemetery was my predecessor as president on the board, and I was vice president. And we were approached by the Pape Foundation through a connection with Jill Barrow, the previous director, with this proposition to restart the life at Earl Harrison. The previous caretakers that that their board had hired had retired and left, and then COVID came along, and so it basically sat unused for a number of years. And the board, which is very small, was trying to figure out how to restart the property. They thought, well, should we rehire a new director to live on site? What do we do? And through conversations with their board, and then as Eric came on, we formalized this agreement where Historic Waco manages the property on behalf of the Pape Foundation.
Okay.
So for events that are only for Historic Waco, we receive the proceeds from those events. If it's something that is for both organizations, we split the proceeds. It allows us a really great event space with tons of room for the kinds of programming we don't have at the other houses.
Yeah.
There's a large meeting room in the back of the Johnson Taylor House, which was the old Waco Garden Club building. Mm-hmm. Also on the property, you have these beautiful gardens. You have the Earl Harrison House. And that's the one I referenced earlier that has is the only house that we know that has ties to enslaved labor.
Yeah.
And so it, when we reopen it for tours fully, we'll be able to tell those stories in a setting we can't really anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So that partnership has been very fruitful for both groups. They have someone that they can rely on to manage and run the property and book the events and work the events. I think Eric's probably lifted more than like 2 tons worth of tables in his time working there, moving and setting things up for events. And we get the chance to promote and preserve another piece of Waco history that helps us to tell more stories in a new setting. Mm-hmm. It's been a really nice partnership with that board.
Yeah. And in addition to that, the Pape board, when we kind of signed this deal, they were really adamant that the space was not just a wedding venue.
Yeah.
And so when we, the first time I set foot on the property, because I'd walked, I'd driven past the Waco Zoo all the time, and I never really knew what was there, because I've only been in Waco for 10 years, and maybe 4 or 5 years, Earl Harrison was closed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first time I stepped on the property, I could just see the potential. And really, more importantly, it was just a space that was unique to Waco, where I think lots of Waco organizations would want to come to.
Yeah.
And really, I think the first year we hosted almost 30 events, and there was like 15 different varieties of events that we had. Everything from, we had Live Oak stage to play of Romeo and Juliet, which was really cool. We had baby showers. We had some weddings. We had
fraternity and sorority parties, nonprofit group meetings, board retreats,
garden parties,
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're trying to do is really reach out to these different like garden societies here in Waco, like the Succulent Society, for example. They're now going to start meeting specifically at or our organization.
Okay,
and we're reaching out to a couple other pretty well known groups, because you know the Rose Society already meets at the McCullough House.
Mm-hmm.
So we're reaching out to the master gardeners. And so we're really hoping that this is going to be a partnership, that it's just like, we don't really view this as our space.
Mm-hmm.
We view this as a community space for people to use it and utilize.
I see. So they'll regularly use that as space. That's the hope.
That's the hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the hope. That's great. That's wonderful. I didn't realize that much activity had been going on over there.
Mm-hmm. It's been a lot.
Yeah. So are there, you said there's tours coming of Harrison, or that's in the works to develop tours or restart tours?
That's in the works. And so when Eric was mentioning, we really want to start interviewing our volunteers, the phrase, like the institutional knowledge that gets lost when people just leave without just passing that down, that's a real drain on an organization. And so when we came in to Earl Harrison, we didn't have a single soul who we knew at the time, who we could talk to, who knew how things were run. And since then, we've since talked to people. We found that, but at the time, we didn't even know. So when we were walking around the property and we saw these stakes around this, it looked like a pool, and we had no idea what the point of this was. And we later learned, oh, okay, this used to be a koi pond. And then it was converted into, there's a big tent that they have. It's 60 by 90 foot tent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they used to have events and weddings.
Yeah.
So when it came to tours, we couldn't find the tour script for Earl Harrison. And so it took us a few months to actually find that. And then, of course, we had to do our research on it and what things have changed, what things are accurate. And that was kind of a reworking of scripts. That's really what we did at Historic Waco in general when I came in. I looked at the foundational documents. I looked at the tours. What are these stories that we're telling people? And what are different ways that we can incorporate Waco's history and bring that into the stories? Like, now we talk about Jacob de Cordova, for example, when we give the East Terrace tour.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just the families specifically at East Terrace.
Yeah.
So in terms of Earl Harrison, we had a bit of a trial run. I guess I can't say 3 weeks ago. In early May, whenever we had spring break, for the Waco Zoo essentially is, or March, thank you.
Yeah.
And the Waco Zoo was just flooded with visitors. And so we decided, hey, we should probably take advantage of that and see if people could want to give a tour. And so we really practiced our tours, really saw what worked, the flow of it. And so now the next step is just working with the Pay Foundation and saying, hey, is this where we want to hire a docent long-term and really open the house? Or is it something where, hey, if you just go to our website, you can request a tour.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of things that we're working on.
Okay. And what are the tours, what are the tour times at the other houses now? When are those offered?
So right now, East Terrace, E&K, and McCullough, they are open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. You know, this puts me of a mind thinking about these houses and these properties. There's a couple other things we haven't really mentioned, and that would be Hoffman House, which is the headquarters for Historic Waco. It's currently sitting next to Earl Napier Kennard. Was not originally on that site. Back in the 80s, a concrete company was doing some renovations and was planning to tear it down, but they worked out a deal with Historic Waco, was picked up and moved, and now it's our headquarters. And on that same sort of parcel of land, we have the Sims Cabin. And the Sims Cabin has gone through a lot of strange renovations in its time. It was actually in Freestone County, and then it was moved and used as a pool house in Woodway. And over those years, it was reconfigured from its original layout to essentially a small cabin that was then gifted to Historic Waco and now sits in the back part of our property. And the renovation has gone fairly well up to the point where we need to get the gaps between the logs resealed with, you know, a proper approach. You call it chinking, to make it weathertight, and then we can actually interpret the space. However, we've gone through a lot of research and learned a lot about that cabin, and we found that what we have now is so different from the original, it no longer qualifies as a state historic marker, and that actually frees us up to interpret it in new ways. We, of course, can tell the stories of the Sims family and the circuitous route that it took to get here, but our goal, and thanks to Eric's skillful management of the process, we've received some funds from the Summerlee Foundation to actually finish the renovations to the Sims Cabin and then begin interpreting it as what a typical late or mid to late 19th century dwelling might have been for an enslaved family. We're going to be able to tell different stories with that space than we might have otherwise. And I think, short of being able to purchase a working class house from one of the neighborhoods that's still around Waco that hasn't fallen to renovation or neglect, that's going to be one of our best opportunities to tell those kinds of stories.
Well, I pushed for a shotgun house when I was on it.
100% agree.
It didn't happen. Yeah. But.
No. And in fact, I was sad to see that one that I knew was still around has since been demolished. Yeah. There's very few of them left. They've either been Airbnb'd up to fancy standards, or they continue to fall to age and lack of care. So yeah, I mean, I don't think we're opposed to acquiring more property, but that adds a burden, and that adds, you know, financial need and staffing needs. So to focus on programming at the places we already have, sponsoring a lecture series where we can bring in experts to talk about Waco history topics under the banner of Historic Waco, that pulls in an audience. We make them reasonable in terms of how much we charge for admission. If you're a member, you get in for free. Plug. But just to be able to do those things under the banner and the name of Historic Waco is one more way, along with the food events and tours and things we're working on, that we can make those connections to the stories without having to buy a new property to tell them.
Yeah, those regular lecture series are wonderful. Waco Heritage and History is a wonderful resource. The Baylor is digitized. Of course, you get the latest issue with your membership to Historic Waco. Baylor is also in their digital collections, have digitized past editions of Waco Heritage and History, but really a great resource on local history. There's several copies of Waco, a sesquicentennial history that Historic Waco still has, I'm confident of. And you can also go by there and buy things like that at the Hoffman House if you're interested in purchasing those sorts of things. If someone wanted to sign up to become a member, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Easiest way is just on our website. You could also just call the office or stop by.
I want to ask Eric, just because we talked a little bit about it, the Taylor Museum. This was also an ongoing conversation about the Helen Marie Taylor Museum of Waco, Helen Marie Taylor Museum of Waco History, which closed in 1997, and is there are efforts now to reinvigorate that. Is there any relationship between the work of Historic Waco ongoing and the Taylor Museum that you can tell us about?
I would say the relationship is pretty similar to the other relations we have with Waco museums. I visited a friend in the small town of Atwood, Kansas, population like 1,500 at the most. And they have just the most tremendous Atwood, Kansas History Museum. I remember going through there and thinking, boy, it would be great if Waco had a history museum. And so it's something that I think we're hoping that when it opens, it's exciting. It really tells the real true history of Waco and lots of different, and actually doesn't exclude things. And hopefully there's a little bit less on Washington and Continental Congress history.
Oh, he loved his time in Waco.
He did. Yeah, he slept right over there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And dropped a piece of tree, it sounds like. Very interesting. Well, anything else you guys want to make sure you get in here? I mean, you're right to do. I'm glad, you know, we talked a little bit, Eric Swanson, about doing oral histories, and I think that's a wonderful effort. When I came on the board in 2008, you know, you still had that generation that kind of carried the torch in the 70s and 80s and 90s of the organization. But I know that's turning over, and that's in many ways that's turned over now. In the organization. The organization's gone through a lot of changes, but I'm excited to see its current leadership. Anything else you want to tease that's coming up that y'all are working on?
So I will say this, and this is actually a story that you told me, Dr. Sloan, that you approached the Historic Waco Board with the idea for the Waco History app. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Historic Waco Board, they said they were just really interested just in the history of the houses. And from what I had heard about Historic Waco during that time, Waco, when I was a student 10 years ago, that's pretty much on par with the experience that I had when I went there. And that is something that I think the original founders of the organization didn't have in mind. I think they envisioned something that was broader. And really, and at the time, they were really inserted in the community with the festival that they put on every year. And so I think our challenge is really winning back the faith of the people of Waco. We've had some great events we put on the past couple of years, sold out events even, sold out weeks ahead in advance, which is something we hadn't done before. And we're really hoping that we're going to be building up that trust and really proving to the people of Waco, hey, we are here for your stories. We're here to tell a diverse history. And it starts with not only just the houses that we have, obviously, but it's much more than that. And so that's really our big plug, is to say, like, hey, we've heard the feedback and we're definitely trying to adapt and tell more stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think y'all are doing some great things. I mean, it is vibrant leadership. You know, I think, you know, it's been a model at times. You know, it's very expensive to maintain these houses.
No one told me that when I applied for the job.
As I don't have to tell you, but, you know, the mission has evolved beyond, hey, we got to keep these things upright. We got to find enough money to keep these things upright. The way you do that is you make yourself, as you said, relevant to a broader community, and tell stories that reflect the diverse history of the community, I think is really important. And I know you guys agree with that. So I'm excited to see the direction the organization is going, because I think Waco needs Historic Waco meeting its mission.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And I think it's exciting too, from the board perspective. This is the most diverse that we've been in terms of age and socioeconomic backgrounds and ethnicity and just ideas, frankly. We need ideas from people who have lived in Waco their entire lives. We need ideas from people who just moved here and have a very different perception of what Waco is. People like me who've been here almost 20 years now and know and appreciate and respect the history, but also know the oversights that we've just not paid attention to at an institutional level, and we need to. And certainly the work that the Oral History Institute has done to speak to some of those folks and to record those stories is inspirational for us. We welcome anyone who's interested in volunteering or serving on the board. Get in touch with us through the email at the website. Call Eric up. Just hang out on the front porch of Hoffman House.
Bring some old stuff with you.
Yeah, just bring a box of spinning wheels. We'll let you in. But, you know, we want to make those connections. And like Eric said, rebuild that connection with Waco that has been around a long time, but maybe hasn't been as intentional as it could have been in making those connections and saving those stories. That's that's really important to me personally and to our board. And I'm happy to say that the staff under Eric's leadership has reflected that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the success of Historic Waco is going to be connected to reaching another generation, reaching the next generation. I mean, it's been affirmed by the older generation as a model, but I think, you know, that call to volunteer, that call to become a member, to engage in some of the programming, to try it. I think Historic Waco is one of the things that makes Waco unique as an organization. And it is a great place where you can volunteer and do I think, meaningful history work. So I would encourage that for those of you that are listening and interested. I want to thank both of you for your service there. I mean, it is something that means it's important to me, and it's great to hear. I hear it in your voice how important it is to you to carry this mission forward. So thank you for your service to the community. One of you is getting paid for this. I mean, not richly, but I mean, one of you is getting paid for this. But again, both of you are going above and beyond the call to do this work. And so I'm really grateful for it. And thanks for coming on today and telling folks about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks for listening to the Waco History Podcast. Like what you heard? Subscribe, rate, and review our show on iTunes so we can reach more listeners. You can find show notes and info on every episode at wacohistorypodcast.com and more info on Waco's past at wacohistory.org. Our theme music, used with permission, is Cross the Brazos at Waco, performed by the late Billy Walker. For more info on Billy's music, go to billywalker.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. This has been a Rogue Media Network production.